WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Taj Mahal singing, who wrote the setting for the poem that we just heard by Ishmael Reed. It's from an album called Conjure. He also did the arrangement for that. And before that, we heard Taj Mahal singing Karina. And my guest is Taj Mahal, who first became known for his blues songs performed in the tradition of southern rural bluesmen like Mississippi John Hurt and Blind Willie McTell. Over the years, he's also integrated rhythms and instruments of African, Caribbean, and Latin cultures. He's recorded many popular records on Columbia, records that crossed over to blues, folk, and rock audiences. He also co-starred in the film Sounder, which he wrote music for. Columbia recently released an album, The Best of Taj Mahal. He's in Philadelphia to perform at the Tower Theater. He'll be performing solo this evening. Also on the bill will be the band. Taj Mahal, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Terry.
You draw on a lot of musical traditions in your work, and I wonder what kind of musical traditions were in your house when you were growing up, because your parents, I think, represented two different musical cultures themselves.
Yes. Each day I live and breathe makes me much more aware of how lucky I was as an Afro-American youngster to be very aware of the type of roots that are available. I'll say briefly that a majority of the Afro-Americans presently are so busy being American that their point of view oftentimes is a kind of a chauvinistic type of view toward being American without understanding that it couldn't be, they wouldn't be here or happen if it wasn't for Africa or Central America or South America or the Caribbean. And it's kind of a ridiculous kind of position to be in. It's sort of like taking the colonialist attitude towards your own people. It's like as if I went down to Jamaica and said, well, gee, the natives here and the natives there, as opposed to realizing that they're my people. And I think you know what I'm talking about. If you go to Israel, you're not going to say that they're over there and I'm over here. It's a part of your blood. You live somewhere, but you don't cut those ties. But, you know.
Well, your father was from the West Indies,
well,
right?
Well, he was raised here, but my grandmother and grandfather were from St. Kitts and Nevis. And my grandfather on my father's side immigrated to the United States probably about in 1897, 1898. And my grandmother came here as an indentured servant and worked, you know, cleaning houses and making food and all that kind of stuff. And my grandfather saw her on the street, and he had remembered her from, she was from Nevis. Now, St. Kitts and Nevis were the, St. Kitts is the first landfall that Columbus saw in the modern world, or the New World. And Nevis is the next island over. And the reason it was called Nevis is that there's a mountain in the center which goes up into the clouds. And the navigators and all the different people aboard, the historians aboard, thought it was snow on top of the mountain, so it was called La Nieve, which is in Spanish means the snow. But over the years, the natives, have, you know, local people have called it Nevis, you know, which means the snows. And then my mother's people are from South Carolina, and both on both sides of the family, they are African and Native American and Native Caribbean mix, because those islands were inhabited by Caribbean Indians. And so
your mother, I think, sang gospel music. Do you feel like you were influenced by the music of the church?
To a form, but
what kind of music was it? What kind of church did you go to? And
all kinds of churches, because you see, it doesn't fall that easy. It's not like you chop the tree down and it falls to the left, and then it chop the tree down the other side and it falls to the right. My father was extremely modern type of progressive, historical kind of person. He was a philosopher. He was involved with Marcus Garvey. He was not a church goer, but my mother came from a Baptist family. She was a church goer and a singer in the church, and my father loved the music that she had. Then we went to church when she sang, or if we wanted to. Actually, we could go to any church we wanted to. So it was a rare thing for, we found out later, growing up, that we could go to anywhere we want. If we had some friends that were Catholic, they said, "Why don't you come and check out Mass?" We would go and check out Mass to see what it was like. Well, it was a little too cool for me, you know, or go to a sanctified church where everybody would play tambourines and dance inside of the church. So we saw, when we were always taught, you know, in terms of being a part of the world as opposed to our little locale, you know, our little area, and our relationship with the world was everybody is somebody, you know, so.
How were you introduced to Southern rural blues? You were born in New York, but you grew up in, I think, Springfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. But it seems that one of the musics that really inspired you early on was the Southern blues tradition. How did you first hear it?
I'm asking you, how are you going to know about Dodie Lee? Right? Or NF Shoshone, people move around the world. You know, people don't understand this. I mean, the Southerners moved to the north. There was an incredible migration of Southerners to the northern cities. And these are the people I grew up with. And down the block, everybody was listening to, although we were all focusing in on Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed and Fats Domino, because that was what was happening in the contemporary rhythm and blues culture at that particular moment, that which eventually was going to stretch out and be rock and roll. These are the daddies and mommies of rock and roll. Many of the people came from the South, from the West Indies, from the Latin part of the West Indies, the English-speaking or French-speaking West Indies, Central and South America and Africa, because Springfield was the home of American International College, so there were an awful lot of different types of people there. But the music and the record stores had lots of B.B. King and Howlin' Wolf and all that kind of stuff, because it served the people who had come from the South. So the possibility for me to have social intercourse with people who came from the South and that be a part of our musical sound was very real. But there was also a line that was drawn between the sophisticated Northerner who would not listen to that cornfield music and only wanted to hear maybe jazz or maybe wanted to hear jazz and could drew the line and maybe Billy Ward in the Dominoes or Clyde McFadder and the Drifters, or any of the doo-wop groups of the time, which actually was low on the scale to the guys that were really up top who listened to gospel only and maybe some jazz. There was an awful lot of division, but the musicians, the guitar players particularly, and bass players and drummers to play, we listened to everything that moved in a kind of an area that moved basically from Chuck Berry being the front forefront of that whole thing, Johnny Guitar Watson, all the way out into Howlin' Wolf and those kind of guys. So I tended to hang around with those characters because the way that they played music and the way that I aspired to play music was not from a reading of the notes, but from a heartfelt, a soul felt, and a spiritual way.
But it sounds like some Northerners really related to that music as being hick music or cornfield music.
Yeah. It's the same thing that happens to European Americans in terms of bluegrass or something like that. They just somehow can't hear it. You know, it just sounds like it's too backwards, this, that, and the other thing. And ultimately, what it is that they really don't know anything about the whole fabric of music. You just can't cut. You can't strangle a root in your life like that.
What spoke to you musically and lyrically about the blues music that you were listening to then?
Well, it coincided with my relationship with women at that time. The northern women were basically kind of cool. I mean, in their whole relationship, they were very cool, whereas the southern women were more warm. I mean, in terms of their relationship, they seemed to be a little bit different in terms of what they were looking for. I mean, at 14, 12 and 14, they already knew how to size up a man for what they wanted to be involved with. The northern women were into Nancy Drew, you know, and dancing close was the worst thing that you could possibly do. Southern girls are a lot different. Plus, they like the blues. And they were always, you know, since they knew I liked that music and didn't put them down for it, well, then they turned me on to a lot. Of course, one of the other real inspirations was my aunt Bessie, who really wasn't my aunt, but she was a friend of the family. She was like a woman who was childless. So our family, we became their children, she and my Uncle James. And they were from Jacksonville, Florida, and they were just like in the root all the time. So anytime she thought we were going astray, Aunt Bessie would say, well, listen, come over, you got to come over and mow my lawn. Well, we'd go over and mow the lawn. Ultimately, their house was being jammed with James Brown, and, you know, I mean, it was like always the real good music. So I just didn't understand how you could have a music that was creating so much intensity throughout the world to be just denied like that. I mean, I just wasn't raised to deny what was real about myself, you know, and that I had nothing to be ashamed of to be a black person and to be a part of the world where I think an awful lot of people, which what I didn't understand is that everybody didn't have the same kind of background as I did, and that there were some different things that happened as a result of my parents being from where they were. And what brought them together was that, as I said, my mother was a school teacher, my father was a philosopher and a musician, and they were just like living a very, very different type of life than what most people lived because they weren't educated or they didn't try to educate themselves. But then one of the things that I found was difficult about all of this education was that everybody was trying to burn these bridges behind them, again, that connected to these wonderful roots. You know, and there was always some line being drawn between, you know, this bunch of people are better because they only listen to this and they know what's the best and all of this kind of stuff like that. And I just said that you can't grow as a group of people in the world if you're making those kinds of divisions. You know what I mean? We're talking about if a person is bad, and even that, I think what it is that when we see those things and they mirror what's not great about us as human beings, but without realizing that everybody can go to the dark side or the light side of this whole thing, you know.
We talk about people sometimes wanting to burn bridges and deny part of their past. Mm-hmm. I think at the time when you started playing blues, that black blues music had become in a way the province of white folklorists. And that a lot of
I understand where you're coming to. When I started longer than when everybody recognizes that I started in there.
Right, you started long before I started listening to you.
when they started relating to what I was doing was by probably 1966 or 65. You have to realize that I was born in 1942.
Right.
I heard plenty blues by the time 1965 rolled around.
Right.
So I was long ways ahead of it and already in tune with it. I mean, I went backwards basically from big band blues, which is what my parents listened to, the Jimmy Lunsfords, the Arnett Cobbs, the Louis Jordans, you know, that type of big band sound, you know, Big J McNeely. Those type, Jay McShann, you know, all those type of big bands with that blues sound. And it went. Then I heard that, but then there was always something else you'd hear. And then what would happen is that I'd hear, like, white country music pop up, and it would have something that sounded real similar, somebody sleeping somewhere, you know, and or there's somebody in the kitchen somewhere, you know, I mean, something's going on. And it was bugging me because I didn't understand why oftentimes white Southern music had such a connection to black Southern music. And then, you know, over the years, we started finding out, you know, you have people raised up on plantations who eventually accept the religion of the colonial people, which is out of the same book. They take the hymns. Only one person, you know, puts the hymns in this particular direction and flats the fifth note or flats the seventh or the ninth note, you know, and it just sounds different when you add this kind of rhythm or you add that kind of rhythm to it, you know. And there was just a lot of interest, and that's why I said I was interested in this lady that spoke before, because she brought up several very major things that I think that people try to pass over when they're trying to deal with the dynamic of what goes on in this country, you know. But the music has really been the one that's, for me, that has been able, you can see right through it. And then, you know, we talk about, you know, Sam Phillips and Sun Records, and that was the classic crossover right there.
My guest is Taj Mahal, who's in Philadelphia to perform solo this evening at the Tower Theater. I'd like to play one of your records, and then we'll talk some more. I'm going to play Fishin' from... I'm going to play Fishin', and I'd like you to talk about the song, if you would, and the kind of guitar playing that you're doing on it.
Mm, okay.
Would you talk about it?
Sure.
Now?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
By
way of introduction.
You have to give me a frame of reference, what you're working on. I mean, it could be, you say you like to play the song first, so I'm sitting back thinking you're going to play the song.
I'd like you to talk about it.
No, I mean, the song is really one of three songs written by a very famous, well, to me, very fine East Texas guitar player called Henry Ragtime Texas Thomas. He is responsible for one of Bob Dylan's tunes called Honey, Won't You Allow Me One More Chance to Get Along With You. He's also responsible for one of Canned Heat's hits called Gone Up Country, Baby, Do You Want to Go? And Fishin' Blues. Now, I heard this through a lot of, again, this is one of those songs that I'd hear and say, no, somehow or another, the way the melody jumps and bounces, it goes back to somebody black. And then I spent time researching it and found out, yes, indeed it does. But what happens is that if it becomes a province of public domain, a lot of these guys on purpose forget to announce who is the writer of these tunes or where does it come from, because they're getting so much adulation in front of them for being the one that's bringing it to the audience. But anyway, this is what happened. So, I mean, it's not the worst that could happen, but guitar playing on this particular type of tune, basically we was trying to get a kind of a nice, easy loping kind of picking sound, three-finger picking sound, which is a combination of Jesse Fuller kind of music, Pink Anderson, John Jackson, a little bit of Snooks Eaglin, and then
John Hurt.
Babe Stovall, yeah, I was going to say John Hurt down the line, but not really right on top of John. This one's more different than the way John would play. John has a certain way that he always kept everything right in that way that he played. He didn't change it around an awful lot, but that wasn't to say that he didn't have enormous amounts of variety and subtlety in what he did. If you're a listener, you know, as opposed to being dazzled by power chords, you know, from some rock icon.
Okay, well, let's listen to Fishin'. This is Taj Mahal.
Mm-hmm.
fishing all of the time. Baby going fishing too. Let your life, your sweet wife, catch more fish than you. Many fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. I went on down to my favorite fishing hole. Baby grabbed me a pole and line, threw my pole on and caught a 9-pound catfish. Now you know I brought him home for supper time. Proving any fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. Baby brother about to run me out of my mind. Say, can I go fishing with you? I took him on down to the fishing hole. Now, what do you think that he did do? Pull a great big fish out the bottom of the pond. Now, he laughed and jumped because he was real gone. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. Put him in the pot, baby, put him in the pan, honey, cook him till he's nice and brown. Make a batch of buttermilk, whole cakes, mama, and chew them things and chomp them on down. Singing any fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing to play the blues. Tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, mama's going fishing, and the baby going fishing too.
That was Taj Mahal, and the recording was Fishing, and Taj Mahal's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Tower Theater. He'll be performing solo. When you first started playing the blues, did you want to go apprentice yourself to blues performers? Was that necessary? Did you want to travel through the South and, you know, meet lesser-known people who might have interesting styles that you'd want to hear that you wouldn't get to hear on record or anything like that?
No, I was really kind of, I was really in another kind of space. I was quite disturbed that the music wasn't being passed on, and that in the situation that I was living in, that it was a fight to get anybody that knew anything about the music to really relate anything to you, because they've become so negative about it. You know, it's like, oh, what do you, well, you know, why do you want to learn about that? You know, why don't you, George, y'all trying to play some jazz or something? You know, I mean, something that's got, you know, and I just would shake my head. I couldn't understand this. You know, I mean, I was really kind of turned off that people were so negative about what was real positive, because now, you know, I mean, of course, it's going to be different. And for this particular new generation of kids, I mean, they're like shocked to see somebody sit up on stage and play with enough rhythm to make them move, you know what I mean, as one individual, when there was like literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people that played music at one time. I mean, it was like so much everywhere that the white majority took, you know, just went off with the music. I mean, it was like considered that, you know, hey, you know, these people are oppressed, and, you know, they've been uneducated and ignorant. There's now they don't have a snowball's chance in heck to, you know, ever be able to draw the full energy out of this type of music. This is what brought Elvis Presley to the forefront, because it was so easy to hear all these people cutting up and making all this music and recording those songs, that the idea of it being played by a white youth, you know, would develop this large market. And it certainly did. But the fact of it is that you can't take that kind of power and hope that down the road that you'll be able to hold on to it, because it's a tiger by the tail. And it goes further than that. Much of this music comes from Africa. And it's a mixture of the two things. And it's like the a hybrid, you know. I mean, it gains the energy from both parents, and it's like synergy. It creates something more powerful than either one of them separately. But the African energy goes back to, you know, different types of fertility rites, different types of things. It opens up different chakras in the body. And people are not aware of this. They keep thinking it's them. Like, I don't think it's me musically. I think it's me in terms of developing my craft so that I am open to allow this light to come through in the form of music, which we can all enjoy together.
You said when you started playing blues that you were concerned that people weren't listening and that the music wasn't going to be passed on to the next generation. Did you see yourself as someone who could help keep the music alive?
Yeah, I thought if I knew enough about it, it was a kind of a shocking discovery. You know, it's like all of a sudden discovering what you should have been doing. You know, and then you know what happened? Well, everybody came north. They got so involved in trying to be progressive that they just left these things behind them. It was like leaving a 16 million volt line. You know, just split in the middle of a swamp, just crackling away. I went like, why aren't people picking this up? You know, somebody's going to come along and pick it up, you know.
When you started performing, what kind of audience did you have?
Primarily, the early audiences that I had were black audiences and churches and stuff like that, because I didn't start out playing blues as such. I mean, I started out singing in church, you know, started out in different types of churches, actually. Started out playing over at friends' houses, small dances or things like that, you know. But as I became more encouraged to express myself with the type of music that I was doing, the black audience really took offense in hearing that type of music, you know, whereby it seemed to bring up a recall for a lot of people. It recalled a lot of painful times, and it's really foolish because now, you know, I mean, I understand it. And see, like, in the context of something like Sounder, people didn't get upset about it because they saw the context of which the music was, and then it was a positive story with both negatives and positives in it. But a lot of people the life was really hard. I mean, Americans, you know, do not really realize the Native American, the oppression that the Native Americans and black Americans and many people from other parts of the world have gone through as a result of them being totally unaware what it is like to inflict those types of pains upon people. As a matter of fact, still even today, we think that we can be very smug and think that everything is okay. And it isn't. There's a man from a cove from Denmark went across this country and did a pictorial of work called American Pictures. And I mean, it is tough out there on the real level. So I felt that the music, there were several things that were happening in the music I wanted to prove. Number one, that you can't just say by any general way that the music that came from black people is all bad and it's jazz and it came out of the old houses and it isn't this and it isn't that. Sure, if that's the problem, how come the signal that you are a good musician, if you're a European American musician or any, is whether you can sing a black song very well. This is what we're talking about. I mean, it's like we shouldn't be ashamed of it or afraid of it, because that's the line that it's all about, you know. And that, I mean, the Rolling Stones did not make it singing English ballads. They made it singing black American music. And so did Eric Clapton, so did the Animals, so did a lot of them. Some of them are a lot more, you know, better prepared to handle it than others, but I mean, this has been the whole thing. So what I'm trying to say is that then if it's so bad, why is this the cutting edge of what you have to prove to be so good with? And then what I also wanted to say, that there were also a lot of people who thought that the music was bad, and that it was only a whining, kind of a crying, kind of a lowdown type of music. And there was, you can't tell me that with all the different types of people that were brought to the United States as slaves, that we all were black and we all came from the same tribe, and it was all one kind of music. Wrong again, folks. It's just like there are many tribes of Europeans, there are many tribes of Africans who brought in many types of different things. And this is important to bring out. And it's the same thing that happened even in this country. People were raised under different circumstances. They were on different types of plantations. Some people were allowed to read and know things. Other people were kept away from reading and knowing, you know.
My guest is singer and musician Taj Mahal. So you were just really surprised, I guess, that the kind of music you were playing was rejected by some black audiences.
By a lot of people.
By a lot of people, yeah. Now, when you started recording, your recordings coincided with the development of the hippie counterculture, and your recordings were really picked up by that group. What do you think the chemistry was? what made that come together?
Well, the chemistry was is that the hippies said, wait a minute. You know, if we're going to go all the way back to the Native Americans, then the next people you're going to run into are black people. And within the Native American nation and within black people, there's an awful lot of crossover between Native Americans and Afro-Americans. And so the possibility is as it follows, I mean, and you know, you might get a lot of people right in, but I mean, I wish I had a nickel for every time somebody told me that their grandmother was a full-blooded Cherokee or a Shinnecock or a Creek or Apache or blah, 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 forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. That's why I was really fascinated with this Indian sister that says, okay, now if everybody's going to talk about they got these relatives, then let's get together and start doing something that makes some sense, you know, form a coalition. And which is what Jesse Jackson finally did, the Rainbow Coalition. Everybody is in here. And that's what I say. Everybody is somebody. Nobody is nobody. But these things are on the way. But the hippies picked up on it because they like blues. Blues was like, there's a record called, okay, Banana in Your Fruit Basket, right? It's put out on Yazoo Records. The writing on the back speaks of something that we did. What it did is that the blues music inspired a certain movement in people's sexuality. It also, during this particular time, as you well know, and as we well know, people were experimenting, opening themselves up. The music provided a fluid move. This is why people liked blues. Blues was very open. It was an open feeling. It was felt on a very basic level. And hippies were open on a basic level. They opened their life up. They said, hey, I'm not going to be a lawyer. I'm dropping out market. You can have everything. But I'm going. You know, or Joe, I've been with you 20 years. I found this great young man from California, and I'm zoom off in the VW. And this is what people did. And more and more and more and more, trying to have something that was not plastic, that was not just locked in. And the music served as a flux. It was a basic. It was relating to the basic people of the land, the Native Americans and black people and mountain men and mountain women. You know, I mean, everybody had great names and whatnot like that. And the music became something that there was. I mean, blues was a big thing.
Did having that hippie audience change you at all?
Well, I didn't see them as hippie. I welcomed them to come along because I didn't have very much belief in European Americans. I thought they destroyed everything. You know, I didn't even know the deer still lived. But see, if you live at ground zero in urban cities, you really think the way everything's set up, that everything is totally destroyed by white American men. They have destroyed the world. They have destroyed the possibility for your kids to live. I mean, this is what you actually feel. You have nightmares about this. And that they've also controlled their kids to the point where they hate you and you will not get an opportunity and a great chance. The hippies disproved that whole theory. They opened their houses. They opened their friendship. They gave their love. They supported the music. They were real people. They really were down. Somebody that I could relate to, and it was heart to heart. I have millions of friends from that era, and time. And now, I mean, we've all been through kind of a long thing because we put out so much energy then. We had to kind of come back and regroup. We're just beginning to come back out again in the 80s. You know, I mean, this is a wonderful thing. And yes, I was opened up to a lot of things. I was turned on to East Indian philosophy. I was, turned on to just being a lot freer myself, you know, and not being locked in my head, you know, by the way I was raised or what was set up for me. And even as much and as far ahead as I was, I mean, it's just that it helped me even become more strong. I mean, it's like when I went to college, I'm going to college. So that means straighten up, back straight, everything, all this kind of stuff, wearing suits all the time. I get to college, all the women are not waking, wearing makeup, people are wearing bandanas on their heads, you know, ladies are wearing jeans and cranky old shoes, ugly shoes are in. I mean, nobody's doing it. I went like, wait a minute. I mean, I'm just getting here and you guys are telling me no. What is this? You know, somebody straighten me out. Tell me what is going on. And so people say, listen, let me hip you to it. All is not what you think it is. Oh, okay. And then so it started making a little more sense. And it's like folk music, you know, I mean, was happening during that time. And then the opportunity to meet a lot of these older musicians that came from the South, black musicians and white musicians from the South, but particularly the black musicians, and they were really extremely happy to meet me because they were in a circumstance that they had never been before. Here they come out of the South where it was like, you know, you didn't look cross-eyed at white people unless they're talking to you and they know what you're supposed to do. To coming up north where these people are revering them and, you know, putting out the red carpet and paying them big amounts of money that they never heard of and, you know, getting them anything that they want. It was like, you know, it was culture shock to them. So, like, in the midst of that, when they saw me, they would ask me questions and I was able to, you know, set it up so that they understood what was happening.
What were some of the typical questions that they'd ask you?
Do you think it's right for me to be getting paid $700 for this show that I'm doing? Why is it all these young kids? I don't understand why all these young white kids are coming to the music, you know? How come you're here listening to this kind of music? You know, you're the first one of our kind that I've ever seen here before. I go like, wow, that's really crazy. You know, and then it was like great. I mean, it's like it was an insane time. You go to the Newport Folk Festival and there'd be 50,000 people coming to the Newport Folk Festival to see 125 black people perform over a week's time and maybe 100 black people would show up, you know? I mean, I would be shocked. How could this be? I mean, why is it so difficult? I mean, it's so terrible, you know? To come and really see the value of this music, that this is being considered a big part, a major part of American culture, and that you should be here to hail this, you know. But so many people felt embarrassed and this and that and the other thing, you know, and basically just wouldn't put themselves out. Now, there is the other factor, too, and these are financial factors. A lot of people, the majority of working-class black people, do not have the money to just go and take a weekend like that. They would, if they're going to go out, they're going to go and see James Brown or Aretha Franklin or Wilson Pickett or somebody at that time who has got records on the air and represents that type of contemporary culture. We have to really look at this stuff from, you know, the full perspective all the way around the question. But in due time, see, that's why it was important for me to do a movie like Sounder.
Who do you see as being the audience for blues music now?
It's opening. It's widening. It's widening. All the culture people, the culture people that came along in the 60s, both black and white, still are around. But, you know, they've been raising their families, paying their mortgages, you know, figuring out how to deal with New Wave, you know, figuring that Oingo Boingo isn't some kind of disease that your kid's going to get. You know what I mean? Or whatever else is out there. You know, some people have been counterculture for so long that they just have countercultured themselves into a place that's real comfortable, you know, to where their kids are uncomfortable with the greatness of the counterculture and they want some action in the city on the cement, you know. So the parents are now starting to move around and say, well, what is this Madonna thing? You know, who is that? Whereas myself in the same thing. I've been in the music business all of this time, even though I started out doing what I did musically. That was what I played on. I played on records because that was what I was doing. This was the music that I was interested in running down the road. But I didn't stop listening to classical music. I didn't stop listening to African music. I didn't stop listening to anything. It's just that I considered the music I was playing a valid music.
My guest is Taj Mahal. I'd like to play another one of your records, and this is Cakewalk Into Town. And can you talk about this song and also why you chose to have the prominent tuba line behind you?
Well, another prominent tuba line. The thing is, you guys are funny sometimes, but your questions are interesting. The thing is, you have to understand is that I am for people. I am for people. I'm for love, for life. I mean, negative and positive exist everywhere. But I am for people. I'm not against things. I'm for things. And my music celebrates. My music, when I say my music, what I do as an artist, I try to open myself up. So I show people how to open themselves up, to celebrate themselves, not in the sort of hedonistic kind of bacchanal type of way, although that's a part of the kind of the carnival type of energy. But I'm just talking about we relied too long on leaders, everybody, every culture. And when they take away your leaders, what do you have? Look what happened to us in the 60s. They took away every one of our leaders. They took leaders from the white people, from the black people, from the Indians, took them away. And we fell flat because we were all had our hearts romantically tied and politically and spiritually tied to these leaders. Instead of leading your own life, you know, it's like I learned how to play as a solo artist, but I also know the politics of playing in an ensemble. You understand? So that makes me, and then it goes back to the same thing. If you want love in this life, then you better learn to love yourself, because then you set up a fertile place for love to exist, you know? So talking about how does this lead back to Cakewalk Into Town? Songs like this, I went through a period in time when I was trying to show people that it doesn't take big bands and it doesn't take big expensive records. And the two records that I recorded like that, Ooh So Good and Blues and Recycling the Blues were done for less than $5,000. That covers everything, you know? I mean, a record company thought that if you spent that kind of money, it couldn't be a good record, as opposed to that I was an efficient artist, you know? So then I went and said, okay, fellas, if you want to go the other way, I'll spend $70,000 or $100,000 on a record, you know, and I'll make some music with that too. But I'm just showing you that here was a bare bones record with a tuba, because I had played with the tuba section, which had brought tubas into prominence. Heretofore, no one heard much hardly. I always thought tubas were bleep, bloop, bleep, bloop, bleep, bloop. That's all they were. They were good for John Philip Sousa's marches. You know, as a matter of fact, some people call tuba a sousaphone. A sousaphone and a tuba are two distinctly different instruments. They're similar, but one's for marching, and the bells are set up differently, so they get the bass section works differently. But anyway, it was just an interesting idea, because in New Orleans, the tuba is the instrument that takes over for the upright bass, because you can't march with the bass, but you can march with the tuba. So the idea of having tubas as the bass line just was an interesting idea to put it on. And then the ladies, Grace and Jane, were two ladies that were friends of ours, and they just were in the studio, and we said, okay, we'll get you guys to put these hand claps on there. And it was like a kind of a funky tune that was just saying that one time I had really had the blues so bad that my face was like permanently jammed. I looked at myself and I said, man, you know what? This music is really making you feel, you know, pulling you down. You have to really turn it around. And so that revelation in my life came out in this particular form of music, which has helped so many other people say that at some point in their life they realized they were really so bluesy, but it was coming from within. Even though things from without were causing that, you had to turn it around to be able to repel that.
Okay, well, let's hear Cakewalk Into Town.
Yes, let's hear it.
And this is Taj Mahal. Howard Johnson's playing the tuba on this. Let's hear it.
I had the blues so bad one time, it put my face in a permanent frown. Now I'm feeling so much better, I can cakewalk into town.
up this morning feeling so good, you know I lay back down again. Throw your big leg over me, mama, I might not feel this good again. My baby, oh my baby, I love the way she walk. When a girl gets sleepy, I love the way she baby talk. Now worry done got scarce, honey, all and work it no got hard. I spend my whole day stealing chicken, mama, from the rich folks' yard. I got the blues so bad one time, it put my face in a permanent frown. You know I'm feeling so much better, I can cakewalk in the town. I want to go on a picnic in the country, mama, all and stay all day. I don't care if I don't do nothing, just while my time away. I got the blues so bad one time, it put my face in a permanent frown. You know I'm feeling so much better, I can cakewalk in a town.
That was Cakewalk Into Town, Taj Mahal, vocals and banjo. That was Howard Johnson on the tuba.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
National. Not banjo. It sounds like a banjo.
Oh, it sounded like a banjo, the way you're plucking it.
Strum.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a
thank you for grabbing me. Yeah. And Taj Mahal's in Philadelphia to perform tonight at the Tower Theater. He'll be playing solo. Also on the bill will be the band. You know, you were talking before we heard that about how you were getting very depressed, and you thought that might have had something to do with playing so much blues, and you wanted to play something that was more kind of joyful, and that's one of the reasons why you play this. Do you find that the kind of music you're playing really affects the frame of mind that you're in?
It's all vice versa, the frame of mind. No, see, now I don't play that. I mean, I never really did. Well, what was happening is that the industry that we're in creates an incredible amount of pressure on the young artist, black or white, you know, red or green, yellow or blue. It doesn't matter. You know, it's like you haven't proved yourself, so we're going to leave. They'll throw you to the sharks. I mean, it is not set up to lead you into this thing. You know, I mean, as young kids that are coming into the music business, I mean, it's just terrible what they're doing to them. You know, I mean, they're not encouraging them.
You haven't recorded in, well, you recorded a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago you had a direct-to-disc.
1978.
Okay.
Yeah, since then.
So what have you been up to?
Lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. Tons of stuff. I've done recordings outside of the country for different things. I've, although people know me pretty much for Sounder, which was recorded, they started to do a 16-segment series of Sounder for television. And it started out with something called Let's Hope It Don't Rain, but it didn't have the original cast members in it. I was only one of the few from the original cast that were gonna, like, you know, oftentimes it happens, it goes real well in movies, and they decided they were gonna make a series based on it. They did the first series of it. It showed up for television, and then they played it a few different times, went into theaters. I also was involved with LeVar doing the soundtrack for LeVar Burton's first movie, After Roots, Just Like a Man, which was a 30-minute kind of documentary on a young boy growing up in the South. Did the music for that. I was involved as an actor in Scott Joplin, King of Ragtime, with Billy Dee Williams and Art Carney and several other, you know, known actors and actresses. different things for public television, public radio, you know, things of that nature. I've also recorded the several things called The Usual Suspects, which were, you know, Peter Ruin, Mike Bloomfield, Mark Maftalin, different things like that. And then, of course, recently with the Conjure album with Ishmael Reed. Now, presently, I'm working in the studio. I'm about at the two-thirds mark. I'll say the halfway mark to be safe with a new album that'll be out in June. This will, since I've been spending as much time playing solo, you can probably feel that it's time for me to go move into an orchestrated situation, to which I'm both producing and directing and singing and doing a lot of different things with it. And we're going to, you know, just not put the music out there this time. It's going to be, you know, set up with people who are really behind me. And I'm not going to be on a label where there's 50,000 other people that I'm in competition with, and that what I have is unique to the label. So they will give me their full attention. And it's on Gramavision Records, and it'll be distributed through the Polygram Network.
Yeah, I wish you good luck with that. It's a good, interesting label. A lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, very good stuff.
You're going to hate me for asking this. I'm sure you're tired of answering the question, but would you tell me how you got your name?
Dreams. Oh. My father was a philosopher. My parents talked an awful lot about Mahatma Gandhi. I had lots of dreams. I had lots of, let's see, how should we say this? I had lots of astral projections as a child. I went out of my body many times in a conscious dream and movement to lands far beyond where I lived. And I met with people like this, and Gandhi was an incredible light to my life in terms of what to do and what type of energy to put out. And I was fascinated as a youngster with the stories from India, as many of us are, and as well as the stories from Africa, Anansi the Spider, and different you know, stories that came up. But there's something about the stories from India that always attracted me. And I was I read probably every encyclopedia that there ever was, the Britannica, the World Book, and of course these things popped up here and there, and it was just such a great sound. What a great sound, the sound of the name, man. I mean, if one while other people pick something, perhaps I should have, you know, dealt with something that was maybe a little bit easier for people to remember or pronounce. I mean, Americans are just terrible. They refuse to pronounce anything outside of their, you know.
We could call it Taj Mahal or something.
Oh, everything. Yeah. I mean, it's been everything you could possibly imagine. I mean,
do people assume that your parents are Mr. and Mrs. Mahal?
Well, it goes from that assumption to that it couldn't possibly be that assumption. And then they say, well, what's your real name? I said, now how can I, black as I am, have a real name? If I gave you a real name, you wouldn't be able to pronounce it because it would be in Mandinka, you know? You wouldn't understand that either. I mean, it just doesn't matter because people are so limited to think about where they're at. You know, I mean, it's just that.
So that's part of the reason why you took a different name for yourself, because you didn't feel like your name was especially your name anyway.
It wasn't my name anyway. It obviously wasn't my name anyway. You know, I mean, so I had a lot of fun, and I've developed an incredible following of Indians throughout the world, throughout the West Indies and the South Pacific and India, and they like the music, and it's also helped them kind of find their way into American music. Plus, I love, you know, East Indian music, well, along with all the other great musics of the world.
Have people had certain preconceptions about you because of your name, and also because of the fact that the first record you made were based on Southern rural blues traditions? Do people expect you to be like an old blues man?
They're what's shocking to them is that I sounded as old timey. I mean, I sound to me when I listen to the older records vocally, I don't have as many moments on those records that I really is happy about. I'm more happy about my playing than I am about my voice. I don't know what it sounds like on the other side of my voice if you haven't heard the voices. I mean, there are some great, great voices in the world. You know, I mean, a voice, and, you know, people who, when they open their mouth, the culture comes through it.
But people assumed false that, things about you.
Oh, yeah, or that I played blues, and I must have been already at that time 60 years old, so right. By now I must be 95, you know. And even people who are similar age to me have been listening to the music that I've been playing, but I just went at the creativity of the music, the beauty of the music, the power of the music to come through me, you know, and really put that in there. And, I mean, I'm aware of so much, you know, I mean, it's like people say, well, you're going through this style and that style. This is all a part of the great fabric of music. I mean, the great mosaic of music. In my house, we listen to all types of music because we hear music as being something that, as a human being, you can take in from any culture. I mean, I listen to, you know, Manitas de Plata, I play beautiful gypsy and gitano music. I speak several different languages. Want to learn more. I think that life is about learning, constantly learning, and trying to grow. And to give this kind of inspiration to people who are immediately going to say, well, yes, it's better for you because you're a musician and you're a famous person and you're making all that money. Sorry, honey. It isn't about all that money. All that money hasn't done anything for the big guys. They're still trying to destroy the rest of the world. And if they would, it was doing them some good, they would, you know, figure something else out to do. It isn't about all that money. It's like all that energy out there, all those souls that can come through you, all that creativity that you can be involved in.
Oh, I want to get in another record before we have to end the show. And I want to play something from a record that you made within the past year, I think, and it's the Conjure record.
No, 2 years ago.
2 years ago, okay. And it's musical settings for poems by Ishmael Reed. And this is a musical setting by Carla Bley, and the song is Wardrobe Master of Paradise. Do you want to just say a little bit by way of introduction about singing the poems of Ishmael Reed?
Well, I mean, what happened was that they didn't have a vocalist. It was really, you know, I did one tune. I was contracted to just do one song,
mm-hmm.
But as it came around, the guy that they had contracted to sing was kind of a very classical type of singer, and the songs became a little bit, you know, stiff, and so they asked me would I be able to handle it. So I came down in one afternoon and did all of this, you know, all of, other than what I had done. You know, and recited some of the poetry. But I saw it as an opportunity to be able to stretch out and let people know that, you know, other than just the blues or cute songs about big leg women, you know, that I was aware of a lot of other music and that this was in between, you know, doing what I'm doing now. And that I think that I thought that people would appreciate it. I certainly appreciated the opportunity to feel that music like that and, you know, translate things into that type of style.
Well, before we hear it, let me take the opportunity to thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air today. And I enjoy your music, and I thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. I'd like to also take this opportunity to communicate to the audience that it's been my pleasure that you have been able to support me for 26 years in the music business. I've had a wonderful life as a result of it, and I should continue, you know, opening myself and bringing out the best of the music that I know. And just thank you very much.
Taj Mahal is going to be performing this evening at the Tower Theater in Philadelphia. He'll be playing solo. Also on the bill will be the band. Well, let's listen to Wardrobe Master of Paradise, and this is what we were just talking about. It's a musical setting by Carla Bley to a poem by Ishmael Reed, sung by Taj Mahal.
Of angels and dresses them to kill. He has no time for fashion, no money's in his till. You won't see him in Paris or in a New York store. He's the wardrobe master of paradise. He works from ancient patterns. He doesn't mind them all.
models have no measurements. His buyers never are. He never cares to gossip. He works right on the floor. He's the wardrobe master of paradise. He keeps right on his toes. The evil city's burned to a crisp from where his clients go. Their eyes are blood red carnage. Their purpose never fluffed. His customers number 7. They have no time to pose. He's a wardrobe master of paradise. Sweat the phony trends or fashion's dumb decree. His style is always chic and in. He never takes a fee. In vogue or glamour or Harper's Bazaar, he's never written up. He's the wardrobe master of paradise. Right on his toes. The ups and downs of commerce.
That's Taj Mahal singing The Wardrobe Master of Paradise, which is a poem by Ishmael Reed, the musical setting by Carla Bley. It's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock. All Things Considered is coming up in just 3 minutes from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening Sunday on the Best of Fresh Air and next week on Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Thank you. Heavy snow coming down throughout the Delaware Valley. Most of the primary roads are still wet, but slippery spots are now found on the ramps and overpasses and less traveled secondary roads. Traffic on 95, top speeds running at about 50 miles an hour. The visibility is poor, and there's some slow driving around Penn's Landing and the Betsy Ross Bridge. Schuylkill Expressway is at a crawl westbound between Montgomery and Belmont, a 45-minute delay there. Eastbound's taking a half hour from the Gladwood on-ramp down through City Avenue. Traffic on the Roosevelt Boulevard is running slow because of the wet snow. I'm Bob Murphy, reporting Shadow Traffic on WHYY 91 FM.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. This Sunday afternoon on the Best of Fresh Air at 6 o'clock, my guest will be white South African playwright Ethel Fugard, whose plays include Master Harold and the Boys, The Blood Knot, and Sisiwe Bonsiwe is Dead. His plays are about the apartheid system and the psychological and emotional repercussions in South Africa. This Monday afternoon, at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by black exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus, and he'll be doing a reading when he joins us at 4 o'clock. We have two special days of programming coming up next week on Fresh Air. Next Thursday and Friday will be devoted to special programs about AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. The Thursday program will be about the medical facts about AIDS. The Friday program will be about the social, political, and ethical implications of AIDS. We'll have many guests on both days, so that's a two-day program on AIDS, Thursday and Friday, next week on Fresh Air. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. The engineers for the show were Audrey Voblaitis. Production assistance for today's program by Mildred Moffitt. Amy Salad is the associate producer, Danny Miller, co-producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Jim Angle.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
I don't think that we can just automatically act like Chicken Little and say, well, there was fraud in the election, therefore we have to run away from the Philippines as fast as we can.
Louisiana Congressman Bob Livingston and other members of Congress are starting to wonder what's next if Marcos is declared winner of an election the U.S. sees as fraudulent. As the count continues, it appears that Marcos will win tonight on All Things Considered.
And these stories, the Tylenol scare is back as authorities find a second bottle of cyanide-contaminated capsules.
Former Haitian President Jean-Claude Duvalier looks for new refuge.
The debate of the administration over discrimination.
The future of genetic engineering.
Bushkin and Bateau, jingles by day and folk music by night.
First, this news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. At least a dozen states have now banned the sale of Tylenol capsules after a second bottle was confirmed to be tainted with cyanide. The makers of Tylenol, Johnson & Johnson, said today that tampering with the painkiller was an act of terrorism, and they have offered a $100,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the poisoner. Police say they have no suspects and have discounted a letter which claimed responsibility for the poisoning, demanding $2 million. The chairman of the President's Commission investigating the shuttle accident, William Rogers, said late today that the commission is looking at data and photographs of the external fuel tank in addition to data relating to the Wright rocket booster. The commission is looking at what effects cold weather may have had on